Okay, good afternoon. So today we're going to continue talking about exceptions, but first some logistics related stuff. So, some anonymous feedback. Your notes and the book contradict each other, especially this last quiz. This was referring to the last post quiz based on when I got this, presumably, so it's hard to tell which to believe. So obviously, I don't do that on purpose. And this is the sort of thing where you could be more specific, probably, and that would actually show up in at least future semesters as not happening again. But let me talk about some things which are differences that might seem like things that are different in the book than what I described in lecture that could be confusing. So one thing is about context. So there was the quiz question where I had an option, the contents of the stack, and the book, for reasons I do not understand, tells you that the user stack is part of the context. I don't believe an operating systems textbook would say this, but our book does. I think it wouldn't say that because usually we think of the context as the things you actually have to change. And the operating system, when it switches between processes, is not literally like copying the stack to somewhere else and then copying it back. So that would be very slow. The book also describes something that's closer to what real x86 does. So when I talked about what the hardware was doing in an exception handler, I said we saved the PC somewhere, and like my sort of go-to guess as to where that would be some sort of special register. On x86, it's saved to the stack, but not the stack you're thinking of. So executing an exception handler on x86 switches to another stack. So when the operating system makes the exception table, it also tells the processor via some special registers or something like that, hey, I would like you to change the stack pointer to point to here when you start an exception handler. So the processor does that and writes things like the PC and the old stack pointer to that stack. I didn't mention it just because when I've talked about this in other classes, having the concept of there being two stacks is a source of confusion, and it's not necessary to understand what exception handlers are actually doing. Because they're real processors which implement them without having a separate stack. They just store the PC in some special register somewhere. Okay, so any questions about either of these two issues? Yes? The question is, how would the hardware set a new stack? It just changes the stack pointer and hopefully keeps the old stack pointer around somewhere. The stack is already allocated, to be clear. It doesn't like allocate new space. That's only something the OS knows how to do. Okay, so another piece of anonymous feedback was the question that most people got wrong on a process, whether an exception handler was a kind of process. So I would have preferred if I had had the foresight to write this question where I made it clear that is a process, like the kind described in section 8.2, instead of just assuming you'd understand that process was meant to mean that. But I do think that there was enough information in the book to answer this question, especially that you should have figured out from the book, I thought, that an exception handler is like a function because the book says it's akin to a procedure call, and I assume most people think those are close enough to synonyms. So I think I stand by counting that question still. And so that's all the anonymous feedback I have. And a logistical note. So, as you know, rotate is due tomorrow. Hopefully you know that. If not, you should probably start working on it. Note that it's, as I mentioned before, based on the timings on our testing machine, which is not the same as LabUnix 1. Like, it's similar, but it's not the same. So I would recommend submitting something early enough that you can make sure that you've actually met the threshold and not like 11 a.m. on Wednesday. Okay. Any questions about the assignment? Is since this is stress. Okay. So last time, we talked about a bunch of very important concepts about things the OS does and things the hardware does to support operating systems. And one of them was this idea of the process, which is the illusion that we give to programs that they have a dedicated machine, which we do by giving them the illusion they have a dedicated processor through time multiplexing, through switching off between different programs, even though we only have one real processor, or maybe a small number of real processors. And an address space, the illusion that they have dedicated memory, which we implement by setting this mapping that the hardware uses every time our program accesses any memory address. That we actually evaluate this mapping and then access the real memory address. So, we had our threads and our address space with these mappings. And an important concept in maintaining this illusion is that processes should actually look like they're alone in their machine and not interfere with other processes with their own fake dedicated machines unless we want them to. So unless the OS allows it, the process shouldn't be able to keep the OS from doing the right thing or make other processes do the wrong thing by, for example, writing into their memory. And our key hardware support for this is this thing called kernel mode, that there's some instructions, like instructions to change the address space or to change the exception table, which are going to be privileged, that we're not going to allow normal programs to run, except when the machine is in kernel mode. And the only thing that will run in kernel mode is the operating system. And the way we'll enter kernel mode is via exceptions. And since exceptions are the only way to enter kernel mode, and since address spaces keep us from modifying the exception handlers, assuming the OS does its job, the OS gets to control every privileged operation that happens. And when we finished up last time, we talked about sort of system calls, which are, since we can't do these privileged operations ourselves in a normal user program, we need some way of asking the operating system to do them, and system calls are the way to do that. And I had this example of a program with a system call. So the system call acts very much like a call instruction, except it goes to an exception handler. When the exception handler finishes, it goes back and executes the next instruction. So we have one syscall here that does a write. When that write finishes, we start executing the move queue 60 to set up the next system call. That's when the operating system returns back to this program and to user mode. And this exit system call here doesn't return just because the kernel has decided that's what the system call does. You call it, and it makes your program go away. And to implement these basically in the kernel, we have a handler, an exception handler, that we use for system calls, and it looks at the user's registers and decides what to do. So in this case, I have a table of functions for handling reads, writes, and I just use the system call number the user supplied and call the appropriate handler for the type of thing they requested. And the idea is that if it's not an operation that the kernel has decided to allow, nothing's going to happen. And on Linux, there's a whole bunch of system calls for all the sorts of operations I mentioned that processes might want to do. Allocating memory, starting new processes, terminating processes, accessing files, and doing other sorts of I.O. All these are done through system calls. Yes? So the question is, if you call something like fork, which will use lots of resources, what happens? The operating system gets to decide, because it's its handler. So if the operating system wants to keep you from using resources, then it needs to make sure that when it implements BRK or MMAP or fork, that it says, you're doing too much, I'm going to stop you. And if it doesn't, well, there might be a problem. And the key idea is that Since exceptions are the only way to access kernel mode, the way the operating system decides what your program is allowed to do is solely by writing its exception handlers really, really carefully. So what your program can do is the set of every possible thing an exception handler that your program causes to happen, be it through a fault, or through some IO which happens, or through a system call, might do for your program. And we just need to restrict that to things that you're allowed to do, like if you're on a shared lab machine, none of those should result in you reading someone else's files. And the operating system needs to do that, and things need to be written very carefully. And this is surprisingly difficult. So, for example, let's say I make a system call, and before I do it, I do something like this. I know some address in the operating system that I'm not supposed to access because of my address space. But I make a system call, and first I just set my stack pointer to that address. As long as I don't access my stack until the system call, I won't crash, there won't be a fault. But this means that, for example, the exception handler for the system call is going to need to not trust the stack pointer, because it could point to something that the user program is not supposed to have change. Could not be the expected. And there's all sorts of other weird things like that. Like if you have pointers you're passing in, they could point to some part of your address space that's kernel mode only, because it's your program, you can make it do what you want, and the operating system is responsible for checking all those things. And this is surprisingly difficult, and one of the reasons why coding secure operating systems is very hard. So any questions about system calls in general and protection? Yeah.
Would there be a way to change the OS that it couldn't stop you from trying to go somewhere else and you have to look at the
OS? So would there be a change the OS so it doesn't stop you from doing these things? So OSs often do that unintentionally. And that's what we say when it has a security vulnerability. That's one of the things which happens. So for example, Linux has had some vulnerabilities where you could end up having the kernel read a pointer to a function from your address space and jump to your address space in kernel mode. That's really bad, should never happen. But the only thing that prevents that from happening is the kernel being carefully enough coded to never do that. And hopefully they always do that. And I guess on the note of can you do privileged things, I have here. So when we talk about protection, many people think, okay, so you have this thing called sudo or root, and sort of the natural inclination is that must be kernel mode, because that's where you can do anything. And it's not. That's not what kernel mode is. So even if you're writing a process with sudo or root privileges where when you access files, you get to access them, that's not because the hardware is in a different mode. It's because the operating system knows you said you want this program to be able to do anything. And what changed is not the mode the processor's running in, but that the operating system has some piece data structure where it says this process should be allowed to do more things. And on a system call, it doesn't say no. That's what the difference is. You still need to make system calls to do anything. You don't get direct access to anything. You still have to go through the operating system. Okay. So those are system calls, how they work. When you use system calls in a real program, you typically do not write code like this. It's very rare that you'll actually write the syscall instruction, and that's really hard to do in C anyways. So what you'll use instead are these functions, which look like function calls and are function calls, and make system calls. And what that might look like is something like this, that here is a function called open, which makes a system call that's called open. And it just does the translation from the calling convention we have for functions, where we don't set this system call number register, to the one we expect for system calls. So we have two things here. So we set the system call number because that's how the Linux kernel expects to know whether you're doing an open or a read or a write. And we also have some extra handling to deal with errors. So the convention on Linux is that when you call a function, it returns -1 usually, depends on the function, but any functions return -1 to indicate an error, and set this special variable called erno. But the calling convention that they use for the system call itself doesn't do that. It sets the return value to a negative number with the error code instead. And so the system call wrapper would do that sort of translation. When you want to indicate the result in a different way, the system call wrapper will do this little bit of extra work to fix that up. But this is typically what you'll end up calling in a real program, is these wrapper functions. So rather than actually making a system call directly. So it'll look like a function call that is the system call, but it's not directly. There's a little bit of code that's in the library in your program that does it. That's not part of the kernel code. And so when you see code that people would say makes the open system call, this is what it will look like, but it's actually calling that wrapper function. And if you want to know how you do, like, what system calls from C look like, including error handling, this is the convention that's used. This is just something Linux and other Unixes have chosen to do, as far as what the low-level system calls that usually correspond to a call to the kernel actually do. So this is the sort of interface our system provides. So I have a few other issues with exceptions to talk about the implementation side of things. So we've seen that we have several uses of exceptions. So we have some where they're deliberately triggered, like these system calls. We have some where they're triggered by something in particular, like faults. And we have some where they can happen at any time. And there are some special problems from the ones which can happen at any time. So the ones where there's a system call, we know what's happening, and it's pretty straightforward to know what the possibilities are. But we have some trickiness with the interrupts, the cases where some external event can cause us to have this exception happen and the operating system start running. This is cases where we have issues with concurrency, two things happening at once, and we need to reason about that. And one particular problem is that we have, like, say, a timer interrupt. And let's say I press a key, and I happen to time that just right. So I press a key while the timer interrupt is happening, while the operating system is working on switching between two programs. And the way I've shown you these exception handlers is the first thing we do is we save all the registers that we need to save somewhere so the operating system can do whatever it wants to do with those registers. So what's going to happen if I have a key press right there? So what should that do? So we talked about something with exceptions and key presses. Yeah. So we could just ignore it. So the question is, what would be ignoring it? So we press a key, and the hardware hopefully is going to do something. And we'd like it to be the case that generally, when we do something on our keyboard, that something happens on our computer. And to make that happen, one of two things needs to be happening. Either the operating system needs to periodically ask the keyboard, hey, do you have input for me? Or the keyboard needs to somehow notify the operating system, hey, I have input for you. And typically, we'll do the second, because having the operating system ask the keyboard over and over again, hey, do you have input for me, is not very efficient. And the mechanism we know of where something like a keyboard can notify the operating system, hey, I have input for you, is an interrupt. So this key press should trigger an interrupt, because presumably, this is how our operating system is going to get keyboard input. So that's going to get an interrupt to know there's something waiting for you, you should get it. And you should process it. Like if there's a program that needs to run because it was waiting for a key press, it should run now. So that means we'll have an interrupt happen. And you can see we've made a bit of a mistake here. In that I'm saving the old program counter to some place where for me to do a context switch later. And I just overwrote it. I just lost where we were originally when that timer interrupt happened. So we were running a program, we started recording its state so we could context switch away from it. Then a key press happened, and we said, oh, a key press happened, I might need to switch programs. I'm going to start recording the state of what was just running, but we're recording the state of the interrupt. Yeah. Okay, so one solution you're asking is could we like use something like a stack to store this? Yes, so that would be one solution, is that we have like a stack of values where we store the state, which constrains how we have to store things, but something we could do, and we need to make sure we allocate enough space for that. So we need to figure out what's the worst possible case. Could I have a key press while I'm handling this key press? How many of them could I have? So that's something we could do, but it's tricky. Because and it's not clear that we can actually figure out how much space we need so we never run out. So there's a different solution that hardware uses because of those issues, which is to just say, we're not going to have an interrupt in the middle of an interrupt. We're just not going to allow it, typically. So hardware supports something called interrupt disabling. So the processor, and its logic to decide whether an exception happens, has all these inputs. Like, does the keyboard want me to do something? Does the timer want me to do something? And it also has this input, which is, are interrupts enabled? And until that interrupt enabled thing is true, this exception logic won't act on that signal from the keyboard, that signal from the timer. And the idea is that when we start an exception handler will automatically disable interrupts, and the operating system will be responsible for re-enabling them, either explicitly or by returning from the exception handler. And this way, we won't allow nested exception handlers except when the operating system wants that to happen. And we won't need to worry about running out of space to store our saved values when we have, like, keep pressing keys over and over again. Somehow, like, nanoseconds apart. Yes?
So if you have, like, a virus or something that you're running, and you want to make sure that, like, once it gets traction, you just let it stop, could you, like, make it so that, like, you disable interrupts for, like what you're running, so, like, no, like, they can't, like, control the scene to stop it?
So you're saying if you disable interrupts, wouldn't that like stop anything else from happening? So that may be something a malicious program might do. So this is true, yes. Disabling interrupts will stop anything else from happening. And this is a reason why it's a privileged instruction to do so. So like setting the exception table, you saw that if I could set the exception table, I can make timer interrupts not do anything. That's why that has to be a privileged instruction. Disabling interrupts would also do that, so it has to be a privileged instruction. So otherwise, if I could do this on the lab machine, I could take over the processor. And we can't allow that. So it's going to be a privileged instruction for that reason. And in fact, operating systems are going to use this when they don't want to be interrupted, not during an exception handler, for when that's convenient. But if you accidentally leave them disabled, suddenly your machine won't respond to keyboard input anymore. Because can't have a keyboard interrupt. And so what disabling interrupts means is that if we have that key press while we're handling this timer interrupt, it won't actually happen until we enable interrupts, either with this special instruction or by returning from the exception. And the idea is that we've somehow moved that safe state into some safe place where we don't have to worry about running out of memory or overwriting the old PC or anything like that by the time we've made that system call. That's not guaranteed. The operating system needs to be written very carefully so that happens. And as I alluded to, so there's also a privileged instruction for explicitly disabling interrupts. So for example, let's say I want to change how I respond to the keyboard key presses. I might be changing some data structure that the keyboard interrupt handler uses, and I don't want it to see like half of my change, not the other half. So what I can do is I can disable interrupts, change those things that the keyboard interrupt handler would read, and re-enable them. And it will only see all my changes altogether, not just, you know, change to part of it and not the rest. So, questions on the nested interrupt handlers in general, or disabling interrupts? So that's all I have about, sort of the normal exception handling. I have some little bonus topics that are operating system-y, including signals, which we're going to talk about because they're like exceptions, kind of. But before I finish talking about exceptions proper, an important note on terminology. So our book calls these things exceptions. Our book calls the kind which are made by I/O or things like timers, interrupts. Our book calls the things which are triggered by some bad thing happening in a program, a fault. Our book calls the things which are triggered by like the hardware is broken and abort. These terms are different for every single platform I've ever seen. Like, no one agrees on what terms to use. This is an unfortunate fact, but it's true. So if you're reading like a processor manual and you see the word exception, it's not actually clear what that is. It's something, some kind of thing we talked about, but sometimes they only mean interrupts. Sometimes they mean all exceptions. Sometimes they only mean faults. And you have to look carefully to figure out which term they actually mean that we used when they're saying something like exception or interrupt. So for example, the x86 manuals from Intel use the word interrupt for all the kinds of exceptions, even though they also use the word fault and exception in some places. Some manuals will use the word hard fault for what our book calls an abort. Some manuals will use the word trap for what we call a fault. I'm following the textbook's terms, but if you ever pick up a processor manual or some other documentation about operating systems or the hardware interface to support operating systems, you will see all sorts of terms, and basically you should like read carefully to see where they define what they are, or ask, because it's often not what you've expected from what you've seen elsewhere. The same thing holds true with kernel mode, though it's less confusing. So with kernel mode, at least you can always tell whether they mean the privileged thing or not, but there's multiple terms for it. So kernel mode is sometimes called supervisor mode, or privileged mode, or ring zero. These are all terms for kernel mode that you might see somewhere, depending on who wrote the architecture manual. So we've talked about having kernel mode and user mode. And this is typically how systems work in practice. But some hardware has more levels than that. So there's like a kernel mode, and some sort of super kernel mode, and a user mode, and like a semi-user, privileged user mode, or something like that. So you might see that in some cases. That's where the term ring zero comes from. So in XV6, there's actually four privilege levels, ring 0, 1, 2, and 3, and a few extra, but generally we only really care about when we're going to call user mode, or user programs run, and when we're going to call kernel mode, which is the most privileged where the operating system runs. So, questions on terminology? This is a very confusing topic. Okay. So we've talked a bunch about operating systems running processes, so our normal programs. And there's another thing which some people would call an operating system, which are virtual machine monitors, things like VirtualBox. So let's talk about what virtual machines are. And one way of looking at processes is that they're virtual machines. They're virtual machines in the sense that what I told you is that we create this illusion you have a dedicated CPU and a dedicated memory. That's what a computer is. So it kind of looks like you have a virtual machine. That's what your process is running. So does anyone not like this characterization? Think there's something that should be different about something we call a virtual machine? My normal assembly program shouldn't be, or not, it's not a virtual machine that I'm running on LabUnix 1. Or what's different between what you usually think of as a virtual machine and when you're running your C program on a shared lab machine? And what that's running in? Yeah?
Virtual machines are a totally different operating system.
So virtual machines have, your program is its own operating system. So what does that mean, for example?
Like a VM is a totally separate OS.
Okay, so it has its own app. So our program doesn't have its own OS. Okay, so any other comments or expansion? Yeah. So virtual machines, you expect to emulate hardware. That's why they have their own OS. So we expect that when we talk about a virtual machine, what you usually think of is something where it looks like we're running on hardware, where we have our own OS because we need something which knows how to talk to hardware. And so we have this difference, that we have this weird interface for I/O and memory, which is not like real hardware. And what virtual machines are the same thing as processes, but they just don't have this weird interface. Instead, they have an interface which is close to the real machine. And people disagree on what the term virtual machine means, and there's people who would say that what operating systems, normal operating systems, are doing is creating a virtual machine, just a different kind of one. And some would say that that's confusing and shouldn't say that. But you can think of them as sort of a spectrum, that we have something that's the hardware interface, and we have something that's this more useful abstracted interface that real operating systems are providing us. It's closer to what a real machine does. But because of this similarity, implementing virtual machines is actually very similar to how we implement system calls. So if I try to access the hardware directly, what did we say happens? So let's say I try to set the exception table. That's part of our hardware interface. In a user, normal user program, what do you expect to happen? Seg fault. Okay, so you expect a fault to happen. And that's going to be a protection fault, and you're used to the operating system crashing, giving you that segmentation fault message. So what virtual machines are essentially doing is that they're running your program the same way, but except when that fault happens, rather than saying, I'm going to crash your program, they just pretend that privileged instruction worked. Another way of thinking about it is that they're converting that protection fault, that you're not in kernel mode exception, into a system call for you. You could have written a system call to do this. You could have replaced all your privileged instructions with system calls. But instead, the operating system's going to do that for you by changing how it handles those errors to do something other than crash your program. So where in our operating system we crash, we'll instead say, oh, did you use the do IO to write to the screens instruction? If so, I'm going to just turn that into a write system call for you and write to your output and advance you to the next instruction and then return. And this is known as trap and emulate. So we take our fault, we treat it like a trap, like a system call, and emulate the operation that the program was trying to do that was privileged. And we might do the exact same thing, or we might do something slightly different. So in this case, our write system call probably doesn't actually directly display something to a screen, but instead sends a message to our terminal. It's a different thing, but from the perspective of the program we're running, it looks like they're communicating with hardware. By doing this, we're providing the same interface the hardware provides, which is what we expect normal virtual machines to do. So one mystery piece here is that we somehow need to know whether we're writing to the screen, and whether it's some sort of privileged I/O instruction in this case, so output to screen. And there's sort of two options the operating system has to do that. So one thing is that the hardware could help it. The hardware could say, instead of just saying, hey, your program tried to do something that needed curl mode, it could say, hey, your program tried to do something that needed curl mode, and here's the operation that was. It was a write to I/O device instruction, and the I/O device was the screen. Could like have that in like special registers. But even if we don't have any special hardware support, we could just read the instruction. Say, what instruction is this? I could read the opcode, say, okay, it's some sort of I/O special instruction, and figure out what it was supposed to do, and interpret it that way. This is what the name emulate comes from. So this is like very much what your simulator was doing, but in sort of C source code that might be in the operating system. Look at the instruction, figure out what it's supposed to do, and to choose something that's like that. So, and then we just advance to the next instruction and return from the exception handler and don't rerun the instruction, but just keep going on with the program as if everything worked out normally. Don't crash it, don't kill the program and print segmentation fault. So this is what I'll call what system virtual machines, things like VirtualBox, essentially are doing. Is that they're turning faults into system calls. That's all you really need to do to implement a virtual machine, except for the not minor issue of how do the address spaces work. But as far as what the CPU does, this is how you implement them, and the only support we needed was that when you do a privileged instruction, it triggers a fault. It asks the operating system, hey, what do you want to do? And because the operating system has this flexibility to do more than just crashing, this is actually very powerful and lets us implement this really nice piece of functionality of virtual machines. With some caveats that I mentioned on the slide, like some x86 like wasn't careful enough about making faults happen. But on good architectures, this is all we need. So questions on virtual machines in general? So as I mentioned earlier, there's this sort of duality between things our process can do and things we have on real hardware. So we have I/O devices on real hardware, which we access through some privileged instructions of some sort. We haven't gone into detail in this class. And we have things like files and sockets in our processes, which eventually access those I/O devices, but we have a different interface. It's the same sort of concept. We have threads, which substitute for CPU cores. So on a real processor, you might have multiple cores that the operating system talks to. In a process, you can ask for multiple threads, which look like cores to you. And we have some way of getting at memory. But the doesn't really have an equivalent on a real machine, though you can set address spaces. And we have this fourth thing here, which is what I say is the equivalent to exceptions. So we talked a lot about how exceptions work on real hardware. And on Linux, there's an operating system feature that is called signals, which is basically like exceptions, but for processes, not for real machines. So it looks kind of like exceptions in that it gives you control when important events happen in handlers that you set up and decide what they do. But it happens in your program, not on the real machine. It's the operating system which runs your handlers, not the physical machine. So these are things which look like interrupts. And they can be triggered externally or by special events. So for example, Control C, that's actually implemented as a signal. So the operating system gets the keyboard interrupt, the real one, and it turns it in to a signal to the program. And the program can register a handler for this. So this is why your text editors probably don't just crash when you Control C without saving anything. That's how you one way you can implement that feature. And these are a way that the operating system can expose some of the useful part of exceptions to processes. And like in an operating system, we would invoke an exception handler that you set up in advance. The operating system, when it starts, it sets up all its exception handlers. When you start your program, you can ask the operating system to set up a signal handler for you. And when the operating system gets an event where your program might want to do something, like the user presses Control C, it may invoke that signal handler for you. So you can decide what to do there. So there's this API for signals, which I have a listing that might be slightly different choices than the book. So the big part is that we have handlers. So on a real processor, when we do exceptions, we set this exception table base pointer, and we have an array of pointers to functions. With signal handlers, because the operating system gets to make it a little nicer, instead of needing to make this whole big table yourself, there's this convenient call for it to handle each kind of signal separately. So there's this call called SIGACTION, and you say, for this kind of signal, I'd like to use this handler. And the operating system decides how that table is stored. You don't get to see it. This is something we're doing because it's a software interface, not a hardware one. There's an API to send a signal to some other process, which is called KILL. So any guesses as to why it's called kill? If it just runs, if we're talking about signal handlers? Yeah. Yeah, so some of our signals, the usual thing which will happen is the process goes away. And this is kind of similar to how faults work, right? When kind of exceptions are faults, usually when we have a fault, what we imagine happening is the process goes away. And that's true of a lot of these signals. There are things where if the process doesn't handle it, the operating system is going to just make the process go away. So one example is Control C. You know Control C usually makes your program go away. You can handle it to make it do something else. You can call SIGACTION and say, hey, operating system, I'd like you to call this function on Control C instead. But otherwise, that's the default action is to make it go away. And because it's useful for making processes go away, the name of the system call to send a signal to a process is kill, because it's often used for that. So an example of what a program that uses the signal API might look like is this. So we have a call to SIGACTION, where we're saying on the signal called SIGINT, which stands for interrupt, which is the name for what Control C is doing, which is confusingly the same as the name for a bunch of other things. We're saying, I want to call handle second. And while we're running this big loop here, whenever you press Control C, we're going to end up calling this handle second function. We're not going to do it ourselves, but the operating system will do it for us. And the way that's going to work is the operating system is going to get the key press, and rather than deciding to return from our read system call and that fgets loop, it's going to decide to jump into that handle second. So what are some differences between this handle second function and what we told you that real exception handlers do? So anything, there are things I'm not doing. So what are some examples of some things I'm not doing that we saw in real exception handlers we had to do? Yeah?
Is this in user mode?
So it's in user mode. So we don't actually know from what's on this slide that it's in user mode, but it is. Because it would be pretty bad if we could just execute stuff in kernel mode. You wouldn't like me doing that on the lab machine and disabling interrupts. So anything else that's different? Yeah?
Not saving the state.
Yeah, so we don't save the state. So because this is a nice software API, that's done for us somewhere. Anything else that we're not doing that we have to do for real exception handlers? So there's the other side of saving the state. What do we have to do besides save the state? What do we do at the end of the exception handlers?
Return an error code?
So return, in general, not necessarily an error code, but returning. We're doing returning like we're returning from a normal function. In a real exception handler, we need to do a context switch, or at least we need to restore all that state we saved. And we don't have any code to do that either. And we also couldn't use a normal return instruction. So the operating system is doing a bunch of extra work for us to make our pseudo exception handlers look a lot more convenient than real exception handlers. And also to make sure they run in user mode and can't like access things they're not supposed to. So one question is, how do we save the state? And it turns out what happens is the operating system does that for us, and it saves the state on our own stack in Linux. This is the choice Linux made. So Linux, while our function is running, it saves the program counter wherever the program was running when it decided that, A, you press Control C, and it saves all the registers, and it sets up a dummy stack frame. And the reason it sets that up is that when the signal handler is started, we're going to return. What does the return instruction do? Pops from the stack. It's going to pop an address from the stack and jump there. So we need to have on the stack some place to jump. And before we go back to whatever was running to this PC when the signal actually happened, before we go back there, we better restore all those save registers. So we need to run some code to do that. So the trick the Linux kernel uses for this is that there's this special function called restoreRT that we jump to first that restores those save registers, then jumps back to the code that was interrupted. And so what happens is we have our handle second function. It does its thing. In this case, it prints a message saying, hey, you press Control C. Then it returns. And because of the way the kernel set up the stack, the first thing on the stack is this, is the address of restoreRT. So we jump to there by returning. And the actual implementation of that on Linux is it makes a system call. And that system call reads the save state out of the stack and the PC, and then switches back to the program at the old place where we interrupted it originally. So questions on this procedure here? This trick the kernel is using is it's making it look like a normal function call, even though it doesn't return like a normal function call. In the hardware, we don't do this because that would be a lot of extra logic for the hardware, and operating systems, you know, aren't going to want to write exception handlers like a normal function anyways, because they need to do very different things than normal functions would do. But for signal handlers, we provide this interface that looks like a normal function and do lots of work to make it work like a normal function, even though we need to save extra registers because we have to save everything. Because we could have interrupted something where we're using, you know, registers that aren't callee saved. Yeah?
So the operating system, so if that saves only the stack of registers, what does the kernel do?
The kernel is the operating system for our purposes.
Oh.
Yeah.
So is this kernel mode?
So kernel mode code is setting up the stack and then going back to user mode after making these changes. I use the word OS because there's a bunch of stuff where you could do it in kernel mode or not. I'm just trying to not say kernel mode except when it actually definitely needs to happen in kernel mode no matter what. Okay. So I mentioned that signals are sort of the analogy to exceptions for our the fake machine our process has, and we have many signals which correspond to machine exceptions. So for example, we have the famous segmentation fault signal. This is what's actually happening when you get a seg fault. So the kernel gets this fault. It says something like, you tried to run a privileged instruction, or you tried to access memory that wasn't yours. And instead of just crashing your program, what it actually does is it says, hey, I'd like to look for a handler for this signal and try to run it. And only when it doesn't find it does it crash your program. But this means that if you want your program to do something in response to that privileged instruction, you can do it in your program by setting a handler for that signal. The kernel will, instead of just crashing your program, it will first try to invoke your handler function. And your handler function, maybe you could do something about it. Or maybe you could at least do something like try to save the current file you're working on. Yeah? So if you handle a signal badly, can you damage your own machine? So no, because as mentioned earlier, the signal handlers are running user mode. So what the kernel is doing is it's setting up this stack and choosing the PC to be your exception handler, and then returning to be the signal handler, and then returning from its exception into user mode. So everything runs in user mode, so you don't have any special privileges. If you try to keep running forever, a timer interrupt will happen and we'll switch to another program. If you try to access memory you're not supposed to, the kernel still gets to decide what to do. You don't get to actually make the machine do things you're not supposed to do. You still have all the protection features. The kernel's just giving you an opportunity to run code in response to these events. But if that code does bad things, it doesn't get to do any more than your normal code could do. And we have, for example, a legal instruction as a signal. So if you execute an instruction you're not supposed to, that triggers a fault. And what Linux has chosen to do is it reflects that back to the program in the form of a signal. So if you set up a handler for that, you can decide to do something else. You can say, oh, I don't work on this machine, I'm going to emulate that instruction or run a different version. Or you can just, you know, not handle it and the kernel will crash your program for you. And we also have signals we're more used to, like our Control-C and Control-Z signals. And you notice that each of these have a default action. So if you don't set up a signal handler, the kernel needs to know what to do. And for most of these, it's going to be, let's terminate your program. There's one case here where it's to stop your program until something starts it again. Stop just means don't context switch to it anymore. And that's how these signal handlers double as sort of a process control mechanism. So in addition to letting you respond to these events, this is how we can make programs do things. We can stop and start them. And because this is part of the functionality that signals hold, there are two special signals. There's kill and stop. So these signals, they look like normal signals from all appearances, but they don't act like that. You can register a signal handler for it, but the kernel will never call it. They're special in that they always do their default action, which is to terminate your program or stop it. And they're, in fact, what Linux has chosen as the API for, I want to kill this program no matter what, or I want to stop this program from running anymore no matter what. Okay. Linux also supports something called blocking signals, which is the analogy for signals to stopping interrupts. So you can't stop interrupts in your program because we don't want your program to use all the CPU, but you can say, hey, I don't want to get this signal right now. And you can set up a mask where you say, I don't want to get this set of signals. And while that mask is set, the kernel will just keep that signal in mind and not actually call your signal handler yet until the mask changes to not include that. And so this is how you can avoid the same problem we saw with exception handlers of what if I have a signal happen while I'm handling a signal? What if someone, what if the user presses control C and then presses control C again? You know, how do I make sure that that doesn't confuse my control C handler? And this is how, that when you enter a handler, it will block that signal so you won't get it again until you're done, unless you explicitly decide, I want to get control C signals while I'm handling control C. This also means that there's other ways of handling signals, which is that you can just block the signal and say, hey, please wake up my program when you get a signal. So there's this alternative where you don't set up a signal handler, but you make a system call and say, I want to wait until I get a signal. And there's not really an analogy to this in physical hardware. In physical hardware, if there's some event which triggers an interrupt, that's the only way you can learn about it. But because our operating systems are flexible, we have this completely different way if you want to handle signals. So you can have set things up so you just have this system call which will return when you get a control C, for example, in this case, rather than having a handler for it. So that seems like not very useful. Maybe? Does anyone think of why would you prefer this rather than having it just call a function directly when you get a control C? What would be the advantage of setting it up? Here I'm just saying don't terminate my program, don't call any signal handlers for SIGINT, and then I'm saying I want to see if you have a SIGINT you haven't sent to me yet. That's what this loop is doing. We're doing with this SIGWAIT. Why would you prefer to do this sort of thing rather than just set up a signal handler? Why wouldn't we not find a signal handler convenient? So, are there things we have to think about when writing something like a signal handler or exception handler that we don't think about when we write a normal function? Sorry? Space? So what sort of space? So stack space we might have to think about because we don't know, it's variable how deep our stack will get, so that's one concern. And this is because we don't know when the signal handler is happening. And there's actually a much more subtle issue with that where we don't know what's happening, so we don't know what sort of resources are being used when the signal handler gets invoked. And this is something which makes signal handlers, even though it seems like a very useful API, it seems like something that would be how you'd want to write programs, maybe, is actually very hard to use correctly and probably a poor choice of operating system design. So here, I have a signal handler, and I have some function I'm going to interrupt with that signal handler. So function foo, which calls malloc. And I'm going to tell you that this code is broken. And that is pretty astonishing, because it doesn't look like I'm doing anything wrong here. But if this is a SIGINT handler, this code and that can interrupt foo, it's broken. That seems really weird. And the problem is, let's think of how malloc is implemented. So one way you might imagine implementing malloc is you get some memory, and you have a pointer about where you're returning next, and you increment that by the size and return some memory. This is overly simplified. Real mallocs are going to be more complicated, but they're going to have some sort of data structure where they track what memory they've allocated, and they're going to manipulate that. And let's say we have a signal, or control C, that triggers this signal handler, happens right here. So what could go wrong? Why could that be a problem? So there's not anything here which directly tells you it would be a problem. So let's think about what's happening in this SIGINT function. I mentioned here it might use malloc. So what does that mean? So why would that be a problem? Yeah, so what's going to end up happening is that inside this function, we are effectively inserting a call to handle SIGINT here, which is going to call printf, which is going to call malloc again, which is going to access next to return and return it. And that means that this malloc call here and this malloc call here are both returning the same pointer, even though they store different things. And one of those pointers is going to be used by printf. Like printf might store it in some buffers that it uses for printing. And our foo modifies that pointer. And that can cause lots of weird things to happen, possibly much later on in the program. And this seems awfully inconvenient, because I didn't do anything really funny here. Like, I used printf and malloc. And basically, in their intended ways. And I got into trouble because signal handlers happen in the middle of other functions. So what was a way I could avoid this situation? What are some things that either I, as the person writing this program which has this problem, or the operating system could do to prevent this from happening? Or the C library writer?
Same thing, like how an exception can't be called and then an exception, like
okay.
Delay it.
So you're saying, well, so we just want to delay the exception. So that's a good idea. So that's a good solution is that we don't, the problem here is that there's some points where we don't want a signal handler to happen, just like there's some times we don't want an exception handler to be run. So what is that point here? What would be a good a block of code to say we don't want SIGINT to happen during, handle SIGINT to be run during? And we have this mechanism I mentioned earlier, we can block the signal temporarily. There's a system call to do that. So where would we want to do that? During malloc. So one solution would be that malloc could here could block SIGINT and then unblock SIGINT. And that would prevent this from happening, prevent handle SIGINT from happening there, which would stop the problem. So one solution is that every library function like malloc that has some global data that it accesses could block all signals on entry and unblock them. That's a real option that would unfortunately be extremely expensive because it means now that every call to malloc has two extra system calls, which is going to be, in fact, make many programs really, really slow. But it would work and it would be a solution. But because it's so slow, it's not the solution that Linux has chosen. So what Linux and POSIX, which is the standard that Linux follows, that is what Unix-like operating systems do, including like OS X, is that they just made a list of functions they call async signal safe. And these are functions which have to behave correctly if they're interrupted by signal handlers. And presumably, the way those functions work is either they don't have any sort of global state, like you saw with that next return in malloc, where we have this pointer re-increment that's a global variable, or they block the all signals whenever they're doing anything important. But this list of functions is surprisingly small. It does not include printf. Sorry. It doesn't include malloc. It doesn't even include exit. It does include write and underscore exit. And this is why my first example didn't use printf or exit in its signal handler. Why I use these really weird calls instead of what you normally do in C. Because I was being careful about that. And typically, the solution I would recommend is that hopefully, whenever you handle signals, you can use something like this, where you don't have a signal handler. That's what I usually do whenever I need to write a Unix program that deals with signals. I try to do something more like this, where I don't have a signal handler. Not always possible. Sometimes I want to interrupt a computation, but it's just a lot less error prone. But because otherwise, what you have to do is know how to write, know what functions to use in order to not have anything bad happen, which is not ones you'd guess. Okay. So we talked about exceptions. So exceptions were our mechanism for the operating system to run in response to special events. Events within programs, including deliberate events like system calls where the program wants to access something only the operating system is allowed to do, and exceptional events like faults where the program did something it probably wasn't supposed to do, when the operating system needs to decide how to handle that. And also external events, like I pressed a key on the keyboard, or some timer went off, or something like that. We talked about the process, and we talked about it in the context of this virtual machine idea, that you can think of a process as a virtual machine, but the hardware has this funny, more convenient interface with these system calls instead of like real devices you access. And we talked about signals, which are this sort of process version of exceptions. They serve many of the purposes exceptions are supposed to serve, but for a program running alongside other programs on an operating system, not for an actual physical hardware. And one reason I like talking about them is that thinking about what things you need to do with signal handlers should help you think about what operating system is doing with exception handlers. Because what doing something in response to control C is very similar to the operating system doing something in response to a normal key press. So questions about any of these? Okay, so as I mentioned before, our big next topic is going to be virtual memory. So this is how we actually implement this address space illusion. This second half of the process illusion, we have the machine illusion where it looks like you have your own processor, even though sometimes we switch away from you, and even though there's some instructions which actually run some other program, the operating system. But it looks like you're the only thing running in spite of that. We talked about how that was implemented with exceptions. And now we're going to spend the rest of our time talking about the address space idea, where it's just how we implement that on a modern processor. There are other ways that have been implemented in the past, but all modern processors have converged on this idea of virtual memory, which has a very particular way of representing that mapping I showed you from addresses in the program to addresses on the real machine. And the reason we've converged on that is that it's going to allow our operating system to do a lot of things that we expect modern operating systems to do that might not strictly be necessary to run a program correctly. And I have some slides on other types of exceptional control flow, but probably not enough time to cover them, and we're going to test you on them anyways. So I will take general questions on either course material or homeworks or labs. Yes?
On the quiz that was due today, the last problem that said something about a page table contains and had like the three choices. I think page 807 mentioned that virtual page numbers was included, but I may have.
Okay, so the question was, there's a quiz question which talked about as the reading for our pages, that a page table entry has entry contains what? And the correct options, I believe, were physical addresses. Was there any other correct option? And permission bit? No?
The book said virtual as well, but that was like wrong.
Yes, and virtual addresses. So, and not virtual addresses. So, just like so the analogy here is that if you think of cache sets, they contain tags and data, but don't contain index bits. And the analogy is the same, that the virtual page number is what we use to find the page table entry, but it's not stored in the page table entry. Just like the set, the index set index bits are what we use to find the cache set, but it's not actually stored in the cache set. And so that's the reason why it shouldn't say it stores the virtual page number in the page table entry. There's other places you store it, obviously, like in the program, a bunch of places, but not in the page table entry itself, because the page number is just what we use to look up the page table entry. But we don't need to look in the page table entry to know what the page number is, virtual page number is. Okay. Other questions? So, that's what I have for today.